Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. You can subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play. You probably figured this out. If you like what you hear, you might even consider giving us a 5-star rating because that matters. They explain to me why it matters. I've not forgotten why it matters, but it just seems like a good thing.
It, right? You know, it helps the algorithm.
I would think so. And we're joined in studio by Nick Gillespie from Reason. Yeah. Hey, you know, I did your podcast.
That's right.
And you got me to use a
You dropped more F-bombs than,
I did.
John McCain at an Iraq orphans benefit.
I was thinking, I'm going to say this, but you'll probably edit it out. And I was afraid I was offending you. And then you just went with it. I mean, it was the lead, that I was all out of bleeps to give, except I didn't bleep it.
Yeah.
So you're down, you're in D.C. here.
Right.
In our...
Yes.
For you're coming going to
the pit of the world. I'm coming to see the to CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference. I believe
you've been there before, right?
You've been
warned.
And well, one of the things that I'm thinking about is I first went to CPAC sometime in the early 2000s or no later than the mid 2000s, and it was more kind of libertarian curious or libertarian friendly. That seems to have faded. There was a period where. From I think it's like 2010 to 2015, where Ron or Rand Paul won every straw poll,
right.
except for one when Mitt Romney won, and that's only 4 or 5 years ago, and that seems like it's a different planet.
You think it's the same people or different people?
I think some of it is that it's different people, but
the same people. That's the scary part.
Well, I'm coming down to take the temperature of the room and see what's going on and whatnot. Because I know Reason at various points. I spoke. I was on panels at CPAC and things like that. And I knew one of the people who used to run it when they had Matt Sanchez, the gay porn star who was a Marine reservist, who they gave a Freedom of Speech Award to because he was trying to gin up an ROTC program at Columbia, and he got attacked by protesters.
Oh, yeah.
So they gave him the Gene Kirkpatrick Freedom of Speech Award.
Was this before or after they banned the log cabin Republicans?
This was before. And then, that was like Go Proud, I think. It was more than the log cabin Republicans. But whatever. And that was Ann Coulter and Andrew Breitbart, and brought in Sophie B. Hawkins, the singer who's a lesbian, and they had a big, literally it was called like a big gay party. And
I remember that.
Weird stuff's been going on. You said before, that weird things are happening in the conservative movement, which I then said was odd coming from a libertarian.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, so you didn't mean weird in a negative way.
Not necessarily. I mean, this is, I know, I mean, you guys, you're the bulwark, you didn't exist a little while ago, right?
And
what's fascinating is that. And watching the Michael Cohen testimony yesterday, where you have Republicans who are conservatives, who would be calling themselves constitutional conservatives, just attacking this guy, and I understand why, but it's not clear what conservatives stand for, but they definitely are behind Trump. Obviously not necessarily you guys, but there's it's something like 92%.
Oh, and you go to this, CPAC when you show up there, and it is a complete Trump fest, and which is amazing to me because. The last time I was there, and I actually have only been there once, so I want to make it clear. You've probably been there like a dozen times, right?
12 or 13.
Now. So it was overwhelming.
It's like Burning Man.
It was overwhelmingly anti-Trump at that time. I mean, there was no question. Every anti-Trump line was an applause line. Right. So that's why I was asking you whether it's different people or the same people, because in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, this is a measurement of the kind of cult of personality that if you were like Rand Paul, freedom, small government, and then you're, build that wall this year, like, whoa.
Yeah. It's a real switcheroo.
These libertarians are not like big on walls, right?
Not really. Particularly government-funded walls.
Yeah.
If you want a wall, build a wall, have your own wall, but
I think a lot of it goes to the power of college students. I mean, when you point out that Rand and Ron won poll after poll after poll, he had enthusiastic, large crowds of millions of college students. And that's a huge, money portion of CPAC where they're able to kind of get the college Republican Young Americans for Freedom money from their schools. And then they come in. But now, I mean, these kids aren't coming in as Rubio conservatives or never Trumpers. They're not going to CPAC. They're just college Republicans, and they're along for the ride. And if Trump's the game, Trump's the game.
And Charlie Kirk is the guy, he's the He's the Pied Piper, right?
But the Rand and Ron Paul folks were a little bit different because they would come to CPAC knowing that they were not viewed as the majority. They were kind of many people. I mean, there was guys on stilts and stuff like that. I mean, they're you know,
yeah, there's always the guy dressed up like a Boston Tea Party guy or something.
Yeah,
like
but I wonder where. I mean, because those kids now are probably in their late 20s. Do they come back to CPAC? You know, there was a wave. You know, do they come back now thinking like, do I really want to go to this?
So you guys were mentioning the Log Cabin Republicans. I'm trying to remember.
Or Go Proud.
The Log Cabin Republicans were a gay group.
Yeah, no, right. You know? But I'm trying to remember the moment when I was in that room where they sell all the merchandise or everything, where they're in there.
The hub, the CPAC hub.
And I had been chatting with somebody, I think from Log Cabin Republicans one of these groups. And three guys came up to me, and they were wearing capes, and they were from some Roman Catholic legionnaire group, and they were like, we want to give you literature because we're leading a campaign to get them ejected from CPAC. No. Do you understand what these people are?
And wait, and the guys wearing the capes were trying to kick out the Log Cabin Republicans, the gay men? I don't know.
Yes. No, but it was like these uniforms, like they weren't
Knights of Columbus. They weren't like fourth degree knights with the swords.
It felt like if you were dressing dressing up like a cop in Venice.
Yeah.
You know, you would dress like
an Edgar Allan Poe story.
Yeah, yeah, very much.
I will tell you, you know, and again, this is I'm kind of interested because, you know, libertarians are somewhat adjacent to conservatives and, you know, other people. But when you mentioned, you know, the Log Cabin Republicans, I can remember going to the 50th anniversary dinner for National Review, you know, where they had their big celebration. Yeah. And it was funny because, like, you know, it was in, I think, the National Building Museum or something. It's this really long, cavernous thing. And, like, my table and where a bunch of Reason people were, like, miles from the stage. And the Log Cabin Republicans were closer to the stage than we are. And I'm like, you know, conservatives and libertarians, there's some real tension here. So, if you're putting the Log Cabin Republicans closer than the Libs.
Okay, so let's get into this. Libertarians and conservatives. I mean, so, like, what's up? Can the relationship be saved? I mean, is it kind of rocky?
This is what I'm thinking about, because this was always, you know, it was never a perfect fit, even during the Cold War. And, you know, when you think of a magazine like National Review, had people like Frank Meyer and whatnot who called themselves libertarians in the 50s. But it was never that comfortable a fit, but kind of communism and, you know, and the threats emanating from that, you know, kind of kept libertarians and conservatives in the same movement, I think.
Well, and he was the fusionism at the time, which was actually a rather extraordinary feat to have pulled off.
Yeah, no, it's, you know, and to go back, I mean, I guess that was in 2005, the 50th anniversary of National Review. It's amazing when you think of what that magazine or what the people behind it put together in 50 years. You know, and it was odd, too, because it was one of Bill Buckley's last public appearance. He was very angry and bitter. And, you know, Bush had just won re-election, but both he and, I guess, Stan Evans, who was the co-MC, they were sour on the Iraq War. And it was a weird thing to see these guys who had built a movement out of nothing, really, and had elected, you know, president after president, really, including the re-election of Bush, and they were real pissed. You know,
well, that's back in the distant mist of time when it was okay to criticize the president, when you could be a conservative and without necessarily calling down all the flying monkeys.
This is, you know, and of course you're helping, you're really warming up to people by calling them flying monkeys. But you know, one of the questions you mentioned, Charlie Kirk and Turning Point USA, and kind of Jim at CPAC, like, is there an intellectual dimension left to conservatism? Because, I mean, Trump, and I don't even necessarily mean this as a criticism. It's as a just an objective description. He is a profoundly stupid person, and that's kind of the power. Like, he doesn't care. I mean, you know, he says the dumbest things, but gets what he wants. But, like, there's no intellectual surplus there whatsoever.
It's the absence of coherent thought.
Yeah.
I went to CPAC last night. We airdropped Molly Jong Fast, our token lib, and I kind of wanted to show her around National Harbor because, you know, Upper West Sider, never been to CPAC before. And we were there at this restaurant, and who do I see but Jacob Wool, speaking of dumb young people who had just been kicked off of Twitter. So I went over with John Levine from The Wrap.
Successor to Edmund Burke.
Yeah.
The conservative
from Charlie Kirk to Edmund Burke, that Jimmy Weinstein fake thing.
But and, wait, can you believe in de-evolution if you don't believe in evolution?
Can I believe in it? You see it. I mean, we're living it.
So Wohl was there, and he just turned 21. He was drinking a Corona, and John Levine from The Wrap and I went up and talked to him, and thinking he was just going to push us off. And, I mean, this kid's nuts. And we ended up talking with him for 20 minutes. And about Twitter, but it was interesting. But what would you say about Charlie Kirk and the kind of stupidity? At some point, you have to wonder, isn't this planned? And I got that sense from talking with Jacob Wohl that he plays an idiot on Twitter because then everyone talks about him, and he thinks that works.
That's it. Yeah.
Well, so, I want to go back to your point, Nick, because you actually go to the heart of something that I wrestle with. You know, my book is titled, How the Right Lost Its Mind, which on one level is going crazy. But the other was exactly the question, is conservatism about ideas anymore? Right. I mean, you and I are of an age where we probably thought that conservatism was about ideas and principles and all of these things.
Yeah, certainly.
And now you wonder, what is the content of it other than...
I'll throw in, I think the same thing about libertarianism and actually progressivism, too, because, I don't know who the next generation of conservative thinkers are. And, there was a time 30 years ago when Dinesh D'Souza was at least trying to be serious, and he's like a crackpot crank now. But I don't even know is there a Dinesh D'Souza, who wrote Illiberal Education out there in the conservative movement. Libertarians, we're working, we're trying, and we have like a lot of good intellectuals, but I don't know if we have the people who are coming up with a kind of social theory of change that is really kind of front and center in a big way. Progressives, one of the things that I find fascinating about the current political moment is that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is like Trump. Stupid. And again, I don't mean that as a bad thing, but it's like she's getting stuff done, just by being aggressive and antagonistic and having a goal in mind.
And charismatic in her own way.
Absolutely.
She's a personality. Yeah. You mentioned that. So Dinesh D'Souza, were you citing him as a legitimate thought leader at one time?
I think when he started out, A Liberal Education, I think that was his first
book. Yeah.
And then, which was kind of an early anti-PC book. And then The End of Racism, which ended up getting pulped part of it got pulped by the publisher because of some problems. But, he was not a crazy person,
you use the word devolution. You could really trace the conservative movement from Dinesh D'Souza when he was one of the young, bright people to who he is today. And how did that happen? Is it because he was chasing certain things, because he... decided that he was going to be provocative rather than thoughtful and all of those things. Should we have seen that coming?
Yep.
Because, one of the questions is, what kind of a debate do we have right now? And we're getting a little pushback for calling out certain quote-unquote thought leaders in the conservative movement. And I was thinking about this. I was thinking about him yesterday. It's like, don't you wish you would have called him out, a decade ago?
I think it was easy to ignore him.
I know.
After a certain point.
It was.
But,
not a good idea, though.
Yeah, I guess not, what was the idea behind, the conservative movement? And is it because you think of somebody like Tucker Carlson, who also, started out at the Weekly Standard, right? Or had a stint at the Weekly Standard.
Great writer.
Fantastic print journalist. And also at Talk Magazine and whatnot. And even a few years ago, he was a more thoughtful person. He is now kind of like a... what's the Andy Griffith character in A Face in the Crowd? Dusty Rhodes or whatever. Ooh. He's like, he's becoming demagogic, I don't know. It's Laura Ingraham, same thing. You're right that it's not that they've devolved. It's just that they've revealed themselves over time and they were never that serious.
Well, I don't know. Yeah. I mean, it's, part of it is, what are the incentives?
Yeah.
The incentives have shifted from being thoughtful and serious and respected to being bombastic and getting high ratings, and being a celebrity and owning the libs. There's some dynamic there because these people are intelligent. And I also think that there's a moral hierarchy, which I don't always explain with precision. I don't think that the real problem of the conservative movement is, the Tommy Lahrens and the Sean Hannitys, because, these people are you know, they really are dumb. We're throwing this out a lot. Dumb as a box of rocks. It is the really intelligent people who have decided that they are going to provide the intellectual gloss to what's happening right now that I think are more serious. So I hold them to a higher standard.
Yeah, who are those people that are not doing their job?
Well, I mean, I think that a lot of the intellectual leaders of the, you know, you mentioned, like, it's the Dinesh D'Souzas, who are smart people, right? People you just mentioned, Tucker Carlson, who I think is sincere. I'm not saying, you know, I don't know how you go from being that to being this. That's the question. So let's talk a little bit about what's going on. I mean, you mentioned Frank Meyer, and then we sort of moved on from all of that. But, I mean, that was an extraordinary achievement because as divided as the conservative movement is right now, back in the early 60s, am I right on the dates here? You know, you had the Russell Kirk traditional conservatives who were diametrically opposed to the more libertarian conservatives.
From what I understand, Russell Kirk refused to be on the masthead of National Review because Frank Meyer was there. And he's like, why am I'm not going to shack up with a libertarian.
Exactly. So the whole idea of fusing together, and maybe it was we overestimate the success, the intellectual success, because as you point out, the big glue was anti-communism. Right. The Soviet Union. And really, so we had the illusion of more coherence than there was. And I sense, and I think you do too, that since the fall of the Soviet Union, things have been cracking up on a rather, you know, line.
The other thing, and this is also partly, I think, the way conservatives, and particularly National Review conservatives, have painted the Cold War as if it was only libertarians and conservatives who were anti-communist. And it's really important to remember that virtually all of American society was. And, you know, John Kennedy and the Democrats and liberals were anti-communists. There were even a bunch of socialists, founded Dissent magazine, who were anti-Soviet Union. So it was, in a way, it probably, you know, there was that glue, but we also didn't need that because everybody was anti-communist on some level. But I do think that, you know, since in the 90s, and that's when I started at Reason in 93, in late 93, and you could already see, that conservatives and libertarians wanted different types of society, or like we valued different things. And liberals at the time, because progressives had been kind of muted for a long time and they weren't really around, there was kind of breathing space, because with the end of the Soviet Union, you know, and the rise of the internet, there was like it was just like, you know, summer vacation had come along, and we all stayed outside and played for a really long time. And we realized, like, I liked soccer, and you liked baseball, and the other, you know, whatever. And it's
we're all cool with that.
Yeah. I think so. And it was interesting. It was also, you know, the other thing, and I was talking with somebody about this, the achievement of the 90s, weirdly, and it's, you know, Bill Clinton gets elected. He's the first baby boomer president. Then Newt Gingrich also, you know, gets a supermajority. And then they are like these great dark twins where they batter each other into a kind of a submissive pose. But like politics receded, even as, you know, everybody, you know, Jerry Falwell was saying that, endorsing theories that Bill Clinton, you know, there were bodies piling up at the MENA airfield and all of this kind of stuff. But
that turned out not to be true, right?
I don't know. We just lost interest in that story. Once the impeachment trial started. Politics per se receded, and people started talking about ideas and also kind of doing demonstrations of the lives that they wanted to lead or the societies they wanted to lead. I think then that, you know, the thing that kind of really screwed that up was first the contested election in 2000, because then suddenly stuff got real again.
Yeah.
And then 9/11. And that's a further real crack in the conservative libertarian coalition, because I think most conservatives went for a surveillance state as well as like a military intervention. And that really, that's a big gap that I don't think has come. And then the fact that the Bush administration and the Republicans in Congress, you know, they spent, they jacked up spending on domestic stuff as well as military stuff. And they were not serious about anything like shrinking the size, scope, and spending of government.
Yeah, Trump is not the first Republican to not really care about the deficit.
Medicare Part D, the child left behind, things like that.
But this raises an interesting question, because
deficits don't matter. Dick Cheney.
They definitely don't matter now.
Or now Mick Mulvaney, you know, circle.
Which is fascinating to see. Like Mick Mulvaney, it's almost like, you know, you're looking at the frame of the picture to see where the gun is in his ribs. So that's like saying.
I remember when he got elected. I was listening to him on C-SPAN Washington Journal one morning. I was a Senate aide at the time. Didn't really know who he was. I'm like, this guy seems like he knows a lot about economics. He seems pretty smart, pretty bright. And then Here he is. Look, deficits don't matter.
We're here in Washington, D.C. There's somewhere there's a building where there's a lockbox with lots of guys' testicles in them. I'm just absolutely convinced.
Well, this
of all
is also
that,
yeah. one of the benefits of Trump, because in the sense of he is really a clarifying moment. Going back to the Cohn hearing or testimony yesterday. So many of the Republicans in the House, they were just yelling at him and calling him a liar and what a despicable human being, as if he didn't spend the past decade working for their president.
As if they were really offended by liars.
Yeah. People are going to be held to account, and Trump is going to be around, either for another 2 years or another 6 years. But I don't think he is I don't think he's like a new direction. I think he's just this weird kind of detour or cul-de-sac. He's I think of him. Excuse me, the band The Police, where, in the 80s, they were the biggest band in the world. You couldn't get away from their music.
Jim doesn't remember them.
The truth hits everybody, Charlie.
Yeah, okay.
But then they went away, and now you don't even hear, no bands, they didn't have a musical legacy, really, like that. They just were there, they were huge, and then they were gone, and we went on with our lives.
I have them on my playlist. What are you telling me?
All right.
Just another sign of irrelevance.
What is your favorite Police song? Yeah.
Okay, now, before we do this.
I don't think he knows who they are either.
I do think that Trump is actually clarifying in a lot of ways. I do sense that right now, because he kind of broke the glass, there's a lot of rethinking conservatives. A lot of conservatives are really disoriented. Unfortunately, a lot of them who are disoriented have essentially decided they're just going to go with the cult of personality, whatever he says, I'm for. But there is this churn. I mean, you have the libertarians out there. You have the folks at the Niskanen Center going exactly the opposite direction. But you're all in play in a way that perhaps, because there is, once you take Trump out, there's no orthodoxy
That's
anymore.
Right. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I agree.
So that may be a positive thing.
No, I do think it's a good thing. I think we also are in this particularly odd moment where, and this again is partly because of I think it was the Republicans started this process under Bush, where money doesn't matter. So the Republicans don't talk about the deficit. Democrats aren't talking about the deficit. The Democrats are now pushing a modern monetary theory, which is essentially the idea that you can just keep printing money as long as it's in your currency and you're the world reserve currency. Well, you can right up until the moment that you can't anymore.
I think the president thinks so.
Yeah, there's a lot of magical thinking going on, and there's going to be, a moment where we really do have to do a reset, and that's when, the ideas that you guys are pushing, the ideas that Reason is pushing, the ideas that The Nation or Jacobin Magazine are pushing, when stuff starts going underwater, people are going to be looking for these life rafts, and, this is
what I think you're right about that.
We're doing.
Speaking of Zimbabwe, I actually have at home a $100 trillion bill.
Me too.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
Is that bogus? Is that just a scam?
I hope you paid less than a penny for it. But, I mean,
it does actually exist.
Yeah.
I used to take it on
a
show.
I have a picture of that somewhere on my phone.
No,
somebody had it. Wondering if that's...
Now that he mentions it, in fact, he has it too. I thought it.
It's like after we invaded Iraq, there was the Iraqi dinar scam.
That's right.
You're paying a middleman the opportunity cost to get that Zimbabwean fake currency.
Is it real or is it fake? Because I have a poster that says something like, is your washroom turning your workers into Bolsheviks, and it's from Scott Towels, paper towels from the 30s or something, and it's saying if you have crappy harsh paper towels in your bathroom, your workers are going to become communists, and I want to believe it's true, but I kind of think it might just be a clever fake.
I used to work at a place that had really, really bad scratchy toilet paper. It almost turned me into a communist. Not hand towels, but toilet paper will do it.
That's how you get employees to not steal from you.
I suppose. You were mentioning before, the split under Bush after 9/11. Yeah. And so Trump, from a libertarian point of view, you must like some of the things that he's doing in terms of, particularly in terms of foreign policy, his wanting to disentangle, at least claiming that. But
buddying
on the
up to dictators,
but on the surveillance,
Kim Jong Un slide for Otto Warmbier,
let me talk about that. Yeah. By the way, by the way, so
fellow Ohioan,
follow me.
Yeah. May rest.
So Rick Santorum, who has been normally a lickspittle for the president, says that Trump's essential apology for Otto Warmbier was a really reprehensible moment. So Rick Santorum is absolutely right about this. It's about the only intelligent comment you could make. your friend Kurt Schlichter then tweets, this is why Rick Santorum will never be the president of the United States. And I'm thinking, whoa, so I it felt like Helsinki all over again, didn't it? You suck up to this murderous dictator.
Trump has been good on a bunch of regulatory policies. Yeah. I mean, kind of loosening those up. The Republican tax bill, which wouldn't have happened without him, did some good things in terms of the business taxes and changing to a territorial system rather than a global, et cetera. But, on balance, it's a real mixed bag. And ultimately, Congress is awful. And so and Trump is terrible on trade and immigration. I mean, I find him morally reprehensible about that. But it's, he's opening up stuff in a way that, again, is like, there's no way the Republicans weren't going to pass a tax bill like that without him.
So. Well, I'm thinking also in terms of, you're talking about just cozying up to dictators and his clear fascination with authoritarians, which is I don't know that there's an American president who has been so unable to conceal his just pure admiration for thuggishness. But also, I do find it alarming what he's exposed about conservatives in terms of how they would come down on, say, the surveillance state, how they would come down on civil liberties. Because I sense that, this is where thought leadership comes in, that we as conservatives, we say that we're in favor of the Constitution and everything, but when it comes to some specifics, other than the Second Amendment, people get very, very shaky about all of that, and I just do not sense that this president and this particular movement would be very solid on that.
I guess I'm going to unmask myself as a Marxist here, but I believe in dialectic, and this happened under Obama, and I realize most conservatives back at the moment when Edward Snowden kind of exposed things. Conservatives were really angry, and he's a tool of Russia, or even if he isn't, he's an unwitting dupe and all of this. But it was really the Democrats and progressives had to be like, Obama is as bad as Bush was, and in many ways was worse in terms of some surveillance stuff. Trump is almost the synthesis, because we had this under Bush, we had it under Obama, and now you have just a complete, utter indifference to privacy or to anything like that. And hopefully this, we're going through so many wake up calls. It's like we can't get a good night's sleep. Hopes is that, people recognize that some of this stuff is important. What I worry about in this is that partly because of we're kind of used to the surveillance state now, and then people are mad at Facebook and Google and Apple and Alexa for listening in on everything. And now they're going to want the government to do more, even as it's already demonstrated that it's already listening.
Except the weird pivot that a lot of people on the pro-Trump right took right after the election. Can you believe that the Obama FBI was spying on Trump Tower?
We're in a Philip K. Dick novel. I mean, where the Republicans are. The FBI is the most despicable organization, and MSNBC is constantly talking about keeping troops in Syria, until the year 2000, 2525 or something.
And the positive aspect of this is the number of folks on the left, progressives, who suddenly are like, tell us more about why we don't like the imperial presidency.
Right.
Tell us more about checks and balances and federalism.
But, you can already see people licking their chops. And another disturbing thing about Trump, and I think what it reveals in Republicans, is the declaration of a national emergency. Yeah. And, Democrats and progressives are already like, yeah, do it. Because the minute, that a Democrat gets in, we're declaring a national emergency because of global warming or climate change or this or that.
This is an easy
one,
right?
People are licking their chops to say, let's have an unrestrained kind of, a will to power presidency and Congress.
But will to power, by the way. I mean, that really is. I actually wrote a piece that offended some people about it. Said, look, all this talk about evangelical Christianity, the morality of the Trump era is Nietzsche. It is all will to power right now. And I thought...
I think he would like Nietzsche. He'd be like, yeah, Nietzsche.
Absolutely. Enough with the wimpy cucks who turn the other cheek, right? You cucks.
The undercucks.
Yeah, no, that's what we got to do with something about this. Where it's all about winning, right? But that vote on the emergency declaration, I know we've had a lot of these moments where we thought that was a clarifying moment.
There were some Republicans. I expected to see Justin Amash, of course, and Thomas Massie. But there were a couple of other people there that I didn't expect, and I was kind of glad to see. Like, I wouldn't have guessed that Kathy McMorris-Rogers.
Or Fred Upton.
Yeah.
My buddy Mike Gallagher from Wisconsin.
Well, when is the Senate taking this up?
They have 18 days. So, and I think that's legislative days. I don't believe that's calendar days.
So that could be like, that's actually sometime in what, 2021 or something.
No, it could, in theory, Mitch could, take the Senate out of session until April.
Do you think they have a,
they have like three,
but will they find a couple, like, you know, Rand Paul, Mike Lee, in a lot of ways, Mike Lee, I think, is one of the biggest disappointments to me, because during the Obama years, he was pushing the Article One project about how, like, Congress needed to pull back power from the chief executive. And now he's like, I think technically it might be legal or what. And it's just kind of like, come on.
A couple years ago, Mike Lee and Rand Paul would have been locks if this was Obama doing it. Absolutely. And then now it's sort of strange. You know,
they still ought to be locks.
Yeah, they should. I mean, Martha McSally, I mean, I kind of dinged her because she all I got assurances from the vice president that, you know, when we raid the Milcon VA funds, it's not going to come from Arizona. And, you know, John Cornyn, very concerned about the bad precedent. And then, you know, just, you know, incrementally he got there. So we're not there yet. We have three. It's Murkowski.
Susan Collins.
And Tom Tillis.
Yeah. Okay, who wrote a fantastic piece in the Washington
very,
Post,
very good. Yeah. I think it's, you got to do the game theory on all of this. It's actually probably the wrong term. Look, as long as they don't have 67, well, they're not going to be two-thirds majority. Right. The president will veto whatever they do. He will still get the national majority. So in some ways, it's a free vote.
Right,
you know, it's like in football where you've thrown the penalty flag, and the quarterback has a free shot. So every one of them has a free vote against the emergency without necessarily having an effect, which I suppose is a little bit wimpy. But I think that if you have a jailbreak, if you get a majority in favor of overturning it, you're going to have a lot of folks follow.
Well, and Andy Smerik made that list of people, of senators who really have no worries. And we had Congressman Woke Joe Walsh on the podcast yesterday, which was great. And he was saying that, you know, a lot of these members are just worried about being primaried and having Trump go after them.
Well, it's when you saw what happened to like somebody like Mark Sanford, you know,
he
got bounced. Yeah.
And that's what they're all afraid of. That's what Woke Joe was saying, you know.
No, when woke, what flipped his switch?
Helsinki. Because,
really?
Yeah, I asked him that question. You know, because I remember when he was the bomb thrower in Congress and everything, and that's what makes him so interesting. Because hey, you think I dropped some F-bombs yesterday. That was a definitely not safe for work podcast. Okay, so tell me about Bill Weld.
Yeah.
Because you guys in Reason had a piece yesterday where basically
Welch,
suggested that we were not being showing a sufficient love for Bill.
So, well, you know, one of the things that's interesting about Bill Weld, and he was, you know, he ran as the vice president, presidential candidate in 2016 on the LP ticket, two-term governor of Massachusetts.
He knew what Aleppo was.
He's a really fascinating guy. And I think he is, like, I like to use libertarian as an adjective rather than as a noun. And he's libertarian. He's in his sensibilities, you know, give people more freedom, make government smaller, you know, but not, you know, he's not like crazy about any of this stuff or extreme. But he can talk about politics in a way that I think I would have loved to have seen him on a stage with Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, because he actually knows what he's talking about, and he can put forth the idea of like a government that, you know, does less and spends less, but also takes care of the people that need to be taken care of in a way that I think is incredible. It's how politics should be reset. He's having the conversation I think we should, like the center part of the country should be having. He is, you know, he's polling at like 20% or something, you know, against Donald Trump, you know, but it doesn't really mean anything. But what he might be able to do is that if at some point Trump has to actually engage him, you know, this is the type of thing where I could see Bill Weld kind of, just talking the way he does, like Trump kind of makes himself into a big enough fool where even some of his followers will be like, you know what, like we're done with this guy.
Well, you know, Bill Weld's problem is that he's completely non-tribal in his politics, which means he's a throwback, though.
Yeah. And he, you know, and this also means, you know, it remains to be seen if he can get any sort of money. It was easier for him to raise money as a libertarian because it's, you're not going against, the father of the party who has, you know, 90%+ rating, you know, among Republicans. So, and it, you know, it remains to be seen if Weld is really in it, because, I mean,
he's in it.
Well,
no, you know how you can tell he's serious? He followed me on Twitter this morning.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
it's happening, people.
That's right.
It's real. Ooh, it's
Do you think the Libertarian Party in 2016 got the ticket backwards?
No, but it's a shame. I'm a big Gary Johnson fan, and I saw Gary, like I followed the 2012 race very closely, and he, by the end of that campaign, I saw him give have a rally at the University of Cincinnati, and he had a 500 people. He got a legitimate standing O. Like, he was really good and charismatic, and I was like, you know what's great? In 2016, he's going to pick up from there and then get mm-hmm. even better, and it seemed like he didn't. He forgot everything, and may have been more compelling at the top of the ticket or not, but it was also, you know, on a certain level, that was the 2016 election was very strange, and you know they tripled the best outcome that a Libertarian ticket had gotten. So
I'm thinking that the model for Bill Weld might be the Eugene McCarthy 1968 model, which is that when nobody else would get in, Gene McCarthy stood up to run against Lyndon Johnson, did better than anybody expected in New Hampshire, and then of course the Kennedy dynasty said, "Thank you for doing that. You can step aside. We'll take it from here." That somebody else.
Matt Welch, who wrote the piece and is following Weld for us at Reason, he brought up there's a guy Joe something, I've already forgotten his name, who primaried Nixon. Mm-hmm. In 1972 and got 5% or 10% of the vote in New Hampshire or something, and then was never heard from again. So that's probably a more likely outcome. But yeah, you never know. And I mean, this is, everything is kind of bizarre after Trump, because again, I don't mean this in a bad way, but it's like kind of phenomenal that he got elected. Like, if he can get elected, then anybody can get elected, and if, I don't know if it's going to be Howard Schultz or Mark Cuban or
Oprah Winfrey.
Make
the case why Oprah Winfrey is not qualified to be president after Donald Trump. Go.
Yeah. She's got a lot of more experience.
So you're going to head off from here, one of the little oases of rationality in the conservative movement, and you're going down to CPAC.
I'm not sure I'm supposed to say your address because, you have so many. But I was walking down the street, and it was like, oh, you guys are in a dental clinic.
There is a dental clinic downstairs.
Yeah, that was. I was like, oh, okay, that's,
We get 15% off.
Yeah,
I thought you were going to say
cleanings every 6 months.
I thought you were going to say we're a block away from K Street. There's a swamp.
Yeah. Is that even a thing anymore?
Is it a thing, Jim?
Okay, K Street's great now. I mean, now that Manafort, Gates, and Stone out. Now it's Lewandowski it's K Street's cool again as long as it's MAGA.
See, I'm actually afraid because I don't really know my way around here, and I fly in from Wisconsin and I hang around, so I'm slightly dangerous, that I'm going to walk into exactly the wrong place, swampy places or something
It's, got to be like Umberto's Clam House in Little Italy or something, and you're going to get shot up.
Yeah, that's right. I'm just looking for some Venezuelan fast food. That's all I want, and I'm going to walk in, and there's going to be Corey Lewandowski and Charlie Kirk sitting around, and the place will go quiet, and it's like, I'm sorry.
Just stick to the food trucks,
What do you see, Jim, if you were in, working on the Senate and, in your ride in this kind of political circle on the conservative side, what was there a fall from grace moment, or is it just have conservatives given up thinking about stuff?
In my personal kind of journey in all of this, I worked in the Senate starting in 2007, and they still passed the appropriations bills back then. They didn't pass all of them. There are 12 of them that they're supposed to pass every year, and then it started kind of rolling into continuing resolutions and omnibuses and all these other sorts of things. And the breakdown in the way the Senate and the House are supposed to, in theory, just do their jobs, I think contributed to it. It's all about brute force and power, and if we have the majority, this is what we're going to do. And it became basically, the Senate majority leader and, the Speaker of the House, filing things back and forth. I mean, when I started, Democrats controlled both, and then Republicans retook the House, and then it kind of became one of these executive negotiations. And it was interesting because when I went from the Senate, where I worked for 4 years, to the House, when we were in the majority, I thought, oh, man, this is great. I got a promotion. I'm going to have so much more influence, and found it was the exact opposite. I mean, the House is far less representative than the Senate is at a you know, committee level. But then you got to see, you know, the breakdown in the Senate with Harry Reid changing the rules and Mitch McConnell changing the rules, and now Mitch McConnell changing the rules again. And it's in Congress, it has just been slow and methodical as various parties have traded power about how they're going to, like, poke the other one in the eye.
I would raise also, you know, the fact, you know, one of, I think, one of my pet theories that is, you know, as you zoom out, presidents that you don't think are the same, or eras go together. And so, like, you know, in the end, it's Carter and Reagan had more in common than we thought, because they were both deregulated. I mean, most of the big deregulation happened under Carter, and then it was carried through under Reagan. Carter was also kind of a budget bust, budget hawk. He, you know, he was a cheapskate, et cetera. And, like, they might have had, you know, there might be a Carter-Reagan era that is worth talking about. I think there's an Bush-Obama, because what you're talking about, like, just the rules of budgeting and whatnot. To fund the war, they did a lot of emergency and supplemental appropriations bills. They bent the rules because they needed, you know, out of expediency and because they could, because they had majorities. And then that gets, you know, then the next party does it, and then it becomes routine. And this is where, you know, I think conservatives or Republicans, like, they need to hold their people accountable. This is libertarians. We, you know, we have a free pass because we don't have anybody anyway.
Right.
You know, poor little us. But, you know, to say, like, no, like, in the end, like, if we had a Congress that was actually passing budget bills the way they're supposed to, and they haven't done it now for, you know, something like 20 years.
Yeah.
That would actually change what ends. It would change the not just the process, but the substance of what's in that, because you can't screw around with that.
On deregulatory efforts, where Trump and Republicans have done very well, and libertarians probably agree with much of it. I mean, the first time the Congressional Review Act was used was the ergonomics rule that you know, came from the Clinton administration. It was like an 11th hour sort of thing, and the Republicans took over and they used the Congressional Review Act, and George Bush got rid of it. Trump comes around and they start doing that with all of the Obama stuff, and they use the Congressional Review Act. You know, not like a scalpel, but like a hatchet. Yeah. And we're going to probably see this, you know, the Democrats are going to look at things like the RAINS Act and all these other sorts of congressional accountability bills that would restore to Congress a lot of what they've ceded to the, you know, the executive branch. And, you know, whether Trump's here in 2 years or 6 years, when the Democrats have control of both bodies, and if Trump's not in power, Republicans not in power, they're going to do exactly what Republicans did.
Yeah. Okay, so in the time that we have left, or we have any time left at all? We can't talk to a libertarian without talking about drugs, right?
Okay, sure.
You know, pot.
I'm not
caring.
Did
you know?
I
was actually, when I came in, I was a little bit late. I figured there'd be like a cloud, you know, in here already in the studio. So Washington, D.C., I have to ask you this, Jim. So Washington, D.C. is like, it's legal here, right? Recreational?
I guess it's technically decriminalized, right?
Yeah, you can have two plants.
Are there pot shops here?
So this is the, you know, the power of the market. The minute that it became decriminalized, a bunch of shops came up, because you can grow your own two plants, which seems very complicated. And I don't know about you, Jim, but, like, I you know, I turn everything to dust the minute I touch a plant.
I live in Virginia, so.
Oh, okay, so. But what happened is that a bunch of stores, I mean, like, an easy way to do it is that you buy cookies. There's a bunch of delivery services, and you buy cookies, and then they gift you a certain amount of pot with each purchase of, like, $30 worth of cookies. And they actually literally, at least in my experience or from what people have told me, they will say, they have to say, you know, here are your cookies. Would you like a gift? And then you say, yes, I would
like
a
gift. Well, it's like a
code. Yeah.
Oh, it's like the gold speaking. But
it's kind of innovative.
Well, because, I was in Colorado last year, and, you know, the shops are everywhere. In fact,
It's not like that here.
Well, no. I needed some Pepsi or something, so I Googled in, you know, nearest drugstore, which took me to the number one cannabis shop, and I have actually a picture of Mona Charon and me standing in front. Now, she's very anti. I was curious, I must say. And I think that
we don't do drug tests here at the Bulwark, Charlie.
This is a good thing. But, like, the folks at the Weekly Standard were, like, all, like, adamantly anti-pot. And I don't know why. Yeah. Because
we're pro-war. And it's a drug war.
I guess that makes sense. But then you give the kids the pot so that they can fight the war.
See, if you had invaded Iraq and then taken all their drugs.
Yeah, I mean, what did we do? We were going to Afghanistan for the poppies, right?
Yeah,
I mean, forget the oil or whatever was supposed to be there, the canal.
I just want to just once again express my gratitude toward Maureen Dowd. who wrote the column about don't eat the whole brownie.
Yeah, but that was,
don't do it.
Yeah.
You take one eighth.
That is a problem with the edible stuff. But, you know, one of the downsides, I think, of legal pot, and there really are none, because everything is worse under prohibition, because it means, like, if you have a substance abuse problem, it's harder to get help, all sorts of bad things. But on the one hand, when you go to these shops now, and it's like going into a really good bar where you can't just get a glass of wine or something.
Yeah.
It's, you know, you have to sit through the lecture.
Yeah.
Like, do you want this? Do you want to feel it in the head or the body or this and that? And it's like, you know, it's just like a buzzkill when you have the docent, you know, like just explaining away everything.
You just want to give me the stuff.
The pot sommelier.
I just want it.
It can be a little bit much at times.
Well, I know, but I did find it helpful. The person who said, now you understand that if you do this, it will take 2.5 hours to feel anything. And it's like, okay, that seems to be defeating the purpose of this. Because I would think that if you're in the pot, the delay of gratification is not your number one priority.
You can drive home, you know.
But this is where, you know, semi-seriously, one of the things about the pot legalization is that it is a shift, and it's a lagging indicator of, I think, a shift that happened because of pharmaceuticals.
Yes.
Where, you know, everybody believes in better living through chemistry now. And, you know, pot is one more thing that you can use, and some people use it very well. I know a lot of people who don't like to drink, but they like pot, you know, et cetera, and that, you know, people aren't using it to get wasted or, you know, to get, like, so baked
it's
that
relaxed.
They can't do anything. It's just to take the edge off and help them go through certain things in the same way that, and Jim, this might have been your experience because you're younger, of, like, using Adderall not to treat ADD, but, like, when you have, like, a big project to do at school or something like that. And
I had my own Maureen Dowd moment with that.
You're talking about, you were talking about needing Pepcid. You know, Pepcid and the acid blockers, my father and my grandfather and, you know, men, you know, and women as well, but businessmen, until those acid blockers came out, and I think they only really came online in the 80s, you just had ulcers or you were chugging Maalox. You know, you remember Maalox
and
stuff like that. So it's like we just, you know, drug legalization is happening. It's a good thing that it's happening, but it needs to be seen in, you know, in the context of, like, we're using drugs all the time, and we can either use them wisely or poorly.
And I do think that this is the libertarian. I do think that there's a generational switch there where the case against people being able to make a choice, letting the market operate, is this is actually a case to say this is why you don't want government telling you what to do. And people who recognize the prohibition is a bad thing, I think this is something that conservatives, but again, I thought the conservative coalition might be headed in that direction. I'm not sure how the Trump coalition is going to handle this issue.
It's fascinating, you know? Because Trump in 2016 was he actually said if Congress put a bill on his desk to return marijuana regulation or like to deschedule it on the national stage and push back to the states, he would sign that bill. He's famously a teetotaler. He was actually pretty good. Hillary Clinton couldn't go there. Bernie Sanders did in the primaries, but Trump, relatively speaking, was, you know, more progressive than the Democratic candidate.
Yeah, but I wouldn't go to, you know, take bank on that
he's good on criminal justice reform, too,
which was a big surprise.
Yeah, and it's kind of fascinating. He has these odd moments where, and this is, you know, where if you're not into the cult of personality, either hating it or loving it, and you take him, you know, on a case-by-case basis, there's a lot to be nervous about, but there's also some, you know, real accomplishments there.
If we can survive. Nick, thank you so much for coming in.
My pleasure.
I appreciate
it.
And thank you for listening once again to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.